WEBR Fairfax Radio. I'm Sue Bartholomew. Welcome to On the Commons. On the Commons with me today, we're going to be talking about a really heartbreaking story out of California. There's a mobile home park with 578 lots on it, with mostly seniors. And they have just been ordered by the court to join a country club that they don't own, that they have absolutely no interest in other than it's adjacent to them. And we're going to be talking to a couple of residents there today. The first one is Shirley Cottom. Shirley's on the phone with me right now. Shirley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Shirley, tell us a little bit about what's been going on in Desert Crest, which is the name of your association, right?
Yes. Well, the park was started, or the community was started, like in 63. And it was built in three phases. They built phase one, then phase two, and phase three. And the Oscar Development Company bought it later. They didn't start the first phase. But evidently, when it was done, it would be, when it was finished, it probably should have went, the ownership should have went to the people. But it never did. Oscar Development Company kept the common facilities.
Okay, there are common facilities?
Excuse me?
There are common facilities?
Not common, actually. They own the amenities.
Okay,
the country club.
Okay.
Oscar Development Country.
Okay.
Anyway, when we bought in, from the get-go, everyone thought dues were mandatory. That you had to pay dues to Oscar. And this went along for years, and there was a lot of lawsuits over the years. Because we own our lots, fee simple, and the streets are owned by the County of Riverside. So there's no common area that's owned by the association, by the Desert Crest Homeowners Association.
Okay.
Anyway, we all were paying dues. And then they started taking things away. They had given people 11, if they paid for 11 months, they got 12 months. Well, then they tried taking that away. So a couple of the owners, the lot owners, got together and they went to small claims court over it. So then he didn't want to do it in small claims court because he said there'd be like 330 other people wanting to bring a case against him too, so he wanted to take it to civil court.
Hold on. Can I interrupt you for just a minute?
Yes.
What were you paying dues for?
To be able to use a swimming pool, and there's a small pitch and putt golf course, and a couple hot tubs, and some shuffleboard.
So he was actually collecting dues for something he owned?
Yes.
That you didn't own?
Right.
So it's not part of the association?
No.
Okay.
No. And we had no say over the rules they make, or the hours they set, or any of this. They were, when this first started, they were supposed to keep the areas up. But we have no way of making them do this.
You have no interest in it?
No. No. And anyway, they went to court over that. Well, when Judge Fry got this, they looked over the CCNRs at the time. And this was in August of 98, Judge Fry.
Is this the first time you'd gone to court on this, Shirley?
Excuse me?
Was this the first court case in 98?
I think there were other court cases before that, but this is the one where it came out where Judge Fry read the CCNRs.
Okay.
And he said it wasn't mandatory to pay dues. The way it was written up, you could join the club if you wanted to. If you didn't want to, you didn't have to. So then a lot of people quit paying dues that weren't using the amenities anyway. And some of them are too old to use the stuff. You know, they can't get up there. And what's happened, a lot of these people that bought in like in 63, they had a better income at the time. This was like a second getaway vacation home for them. Well, now they're living here. Their incomes went way down, and of course the dues go up all the time. And a lot of them just can't afford it. And they can't use it anyway. You know. So they quit paying. So then, Mr. after this happened, well, Mr. Ford came in here.
Who's Mr. Ford?
He was just a homeowner at the time, we thought. But we think that Mr. Erickson, who owns who is the CEO of OSCA Development Company,
yeah,
brought him in because he wasn't here 2 months. And they started doing a recall. And we have copies of checks for Erickson had given him money, and it says for recall.
On the check, recall. It says for recall.
Yeah. So Erickson was trying to get a board of directors in that he could control, in other words.
So the developer had turned over the association basically to the homeowners and retained ownership of the country club.
Yes.
And then he wanted to force everybody to belong to the country club. So he bought this guy and had him recall the existing board. Am I understanding you correctly, Shirley?
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, then when Mr. Ford came in and they got a recall, he got himself elected. And then after Judge Fry's ruling, Mr. Ford he resigned from the board. And then they they were going to have the annual meeting. And so he brought this up from the floor to put an amendment in to do an end run around Judge Fry's ruling. And he wanted to make the amendment where everybody had to pay. Well, there was fraudulent proxies. We've got proof of a lot of this stuff, and we have went to the district attorney's office. We've talked to Jim Batten's office, but we can't get anybody to help us on any of this. Nobody wants to do anything about any of it.
So you have proof that the proxies were interfered with?
We have some affidavits. Now the people have passed away that signed the affidavits that they did not. It's not their signature on the proxies.
Oh, you mean the signatures were fraudulent?
Mm-hmm.
On the proxies?
Yeah.
So they rigged an election.
Excuse me?
They rigged the election.
Yes.
Okay. Is this where they came up with the 300 people who were for the mandatory dues?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Ford had his own proxies made up, and he had this on his proxies. It wasn't on the board's proxies because it hadn't even been put on the agenda. And the way they did that, when he brought this up from the floor, then they just had people holding up their hands to vote to put it on the agenda.
Okay.
And other people counting the hands. It was just, we have a videotape of the meeting, and it was just a farce, the way it was done. But anyway, he had his 300 proxies with that on there and already marked that they wanted to put the amendment in. So they passed the amendment. Well, then immediately Ford came in, he left, he resigned again at the end of 99. In January of 2000, he came back as manager, him and his wife, as manager of the country club.
Ooh.
And then he immediately took like 15 people to small claims court for not paying the dues. Well, in small claims court, the judge went for the homeowner and said that he would go with anybody else he brought in, he would rule for the homeowners unless the appellate court struck down Judge Fry's ruling. Well, the appellate court in May of 2000 upheld Judge Fry's ruling that it wasn't mandatory to pay dues. So then he waited until October of 2000, and he filed suit against 12 blocks, which there was like 21 individuals listed on the suit.
Mm-hmm.
And then that didn't get heard until August of 2002. And by then, people had either died off or some of them gave them their lots just to get out of the lawsuit. And it wound up there's only 8 of us, 4 lots, to pay to defend ourselves, to hire an attorney to even defend ourselves.
Wow. So,
but we won that. Judge Stafford ruled in our favor. Well, then they appealed it again. Well, now the appellate court, it looks like, are going to uphold their rulings. And Peters and Friedman, I've read the briefs that they've made, and they make it sound like there's a lot of places around this valley that are the same way, have an adjacent country club that they have to pay. But we were told that we're only one of two developments that are like this in Riverside County and probably in California even, because all the others have went common interest, you know. But these two didn't. Somehow or other, they were let keep this, you know.
So presumably the developer decided to keep and make money on the common areas, and he couldn't do that. Is that why he decided to hold a gun to everybody's head and collect mandatory dues? Was he having a problem maintaining the country club? Is that what happened?
Well, no. There was a while, and this was when everybody was paying dues. They were letting the maintenance go. The pool was in really bad shape. And I think a lot of people got together and were threatening to withhold dues to get them to do the maintenance that needed to be done.
Oh, I see.
Anyway, they did finally do the maintenance on it. But at that time, you know, they had turned off the hot water in the showers. They'd even locked the door one time when, at one of the elections, Mr. Ford had brought in a bunch of proxies, and they weren't going to accept those proxies, and they told him. So when we went for the meeting, the country club had locked the doors, so we couldn't get in to have the meeting.
Oh.
They'd just done all kinds of stuff, and then at one point we were in a meeting, and they had us locked in, and they had a security guard there. Well, someone called the fire department, and they unlocked the doors then, because they had a whole room full of people, probably 150, 200 people locked in.
You're kidding.
No, they've done all kinds of things like this. This is what I can't understand, how they keep getting away with all this stuff. But
was any of this brought up in the lawsuit, Shirley, that you know of?
No. The attorney we first had was one that had helped the homeowners in here before, and he wasn't charging a lot of money. Well, then he was going to go that way. Well, he passed away. When we hired Mr. Zittimer, he was trying to keep the cost down for us and to go an easier way that he thought would still get us, you know, where we wouldn't have to pay the dues.
Mm-hmm.
And so none of this was brought out in court, actually. We have taken it to the district attorney's office and, like I said, into Mr. Batten's office and showed them proof of the stuff that we had. But the district attorney's office said that they didn't have time to fool with this. It was a civil case. And we haven't been able to get any help anywhere. And we've even talked to Supervisor Wilson's office on what kind of a park are we? I mean, what kind of a community are we? We're not Davis Sterling. We just kind of fell through the cracks there, you know. So there's no law on this kind. You can't find hardly any cases that, you know, to go by on this.
So basically you're writing the law, but you're have a gun to your head, and you're being forced to pay dues to a country club that's owned, operated, maintained, managed, and all of that by a third party.
Yes.
It's almost like making you belong to a movie theater.
Yes. And it's also open to the public.
So it's not for...
Non-exclusive.
It's non-exclusive.
No.
And it's a business. So you're
yes.
being held, you're being forced to provide funds for a business?
Yes. And it's, they call it Desert Crest Country Club, but it's not the houses in here are all, most of them, at least some of them are 30 years old or more. And there's not, you know, there's only a few that are even 6 years old, you know. But they're really older mobile homes. And they say they increase the value, having the country club there. You can't. We know of some that have sold as low as $15,000
for the homes.
Yeah, for the mobiles. Well, a lot of people, when all this lawsuit started, they just want out of here. Or if someone passes away, then the kids are too young to move in anyway. They don't want to mess with any of it, so they sell it for nothing, so they can get out of here. And the property values haven't went up at all. They've went down. In the years since we've been here, way down.
So then nothing's increasing. What about the lots themselves? I mean, I guess nobody really wants to move in there.
Well, see, what happened when they built the place. They made the lot smaller. That's why they had to do the common areas. They had to have the common areas because they...
By common areas, you're talking about the country club.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And I guess at one point, from this is hearsay on my part, but I think it's true, the little golf course was owned by somebody else. But then when he wanted to build Phase 3, he didn't have enough common area to make the lots this small, so he had to buy the small golf course so he'd have enough common area. Well, then when he brought Ford in here, too, he was trying to build Phase 4. He owned some more property around this property. And he wanted to build another 600 homes, family homes, single-family homes, and use the amenities that are here already.
By common area, you're talking about recreational. It's not common because it's not owned by the association.
Right. It's not common area, actually. It's just recreational area.
It's just recreational area. It's open space that's owned by someone else.
Yes.
And the fact that it's there provides the open space that is required to increase the density, which means that you get smaller lots, right?
Right.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure that I understood that.
Yeah, and on Phase 4, the Planning Commission would not allow it. So he couldn't build Phase 4.
Phase 4 was the single-family homes that he was going to build.
Right.
And that's why he bought the golf course?
Well, I think he had to buy that for Phase 3.
Okay.
If he would have done Phase 4, he was planning on making a little park area and a storage area, I think, for RVs.
Okay.
To make enough space to make the lot smaller.
Okay. So, Shirley, bear with me for a minute. I think, let me see if I understand this. In order to increase the density, he had to provide open space. The open
Yes.
space was not part of the association. It was privately owned by him.
Yes.
And now he wants you to pay dues to a business that he owns, right?
Yes.
I've got that straight.
Yes.
And you've been in and out of the court system, and it's cost you a small fortune so far, hasn't it?
Yes. It really has. We're out over $35,000 in attorney fees so far, and it's not over.
And if this appellate decision stands, I mean, are you planning on appealing it, or are you going to be stuck with this? Is it cheaper to go ahead and pay the dues?
Well, the only thing we could do is try to get the Superior Court to hear it. And our attorney says he doubts that they would even hear it.
The Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah, the Supreme Court. I'm sorry. So if it holds up, we'll probably be stuck with it. And then we'll also have to pay their attorney fees and costs, probably.
How much are the dues for the country club?
They're 78-something a month. $78.50 a month, I think.
So it's almost $1,000 a year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
a little over $1,000, I think.
I've done some research on this. I've gone in and tried to read everything I could find about it. One of your neighbors was saying, you know, if I have to pay the dues, then I won't be able to buy groceries or my medicines.
I'm sure that's right. There's a lot of older women, especially that are widowers now. And they're living probably on $600 to $1,000 a month is probably what they're living on, because they just have Social Security. And they retired years ago, so their Social Security isn't that good. I know there's a lot of them that won't be able to do this. And they're going to come back on all those for back dues, and they're asking for 10% interest and late fees.
Oh, wait a minute. They're going back? They want to collect from before?
They want to collect from in July of 99 when they made the amendment.
And so people, wow. So they want to go back and collect $1,000 a year for the last 4 years.
Yes.
Plus interest, plus penalties.
Well, actually, they'll only be able to do for like 3 years because they sold, Oscar sold the country club last July in 2002. But then the new owners will be able to go back.
And collect from July of 1999.
Yeah. Well, the new owners would collect from July of 2002.
Oh, 2000.
Oscar will collect from
99
until 2002.
What happens to the people who can't afford to pay this, Shirley?
Well, I would think they'll probably foreclose on their homes.
So they would lose their homes. Is that what they mean by protecting property values?
I guess.
Oh, man, that's really sad. And nobody in the California government will step in and look at the fraud?
We haven't been able to get anyone to. Like I said, I didn't personally go to the district attorney's office, but I know several people that did, and they took proof. They took canceled checks and affidavits from people that they hadn't signed the proxies, and we still weren't able to get anyone to do anything.
Did they give you any reason?
Well, the district attorney's office said it sounded like a civil case, that they didn't have time. They had too many rapes and murderers.
Well, this sounds like a crime. You don't defraud someone and call it a civil case.
I know. That's what we thought.
And so the DA is calling it a civil case and saying, hey, you guys, you're on your own.
Yes.
And the judge is saying, guess what? You agreed to this.
Well, the appellate court is. Now, Judge Stafford ruled on our side. And he, in his ruling, he said you can't make people pay a third party unless they agree to it. But the appellate court is saying that doesn't have to be that way. That we will benefit because of the country clubs there. That will increase the value of our property.
Shirley, I hope that somehow this mess gets cleaned up. My heart goes out to all of you out there. Is there anything you'd like to tell the people who are listening in today?
Well, for one thing, if you're going to buy into Withers, the homeowners association, you better really look into it carefully. Because I know now that this is happening in Davis Sterling Parks, too. You have a homeowners association, and that's what happens here. You get a board that they want to rule everything, and they make all these rules that it's just unreasonable. And then they go after people's homes, and I would never buy into another homeowners association.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you so much for joining us today, Shirley. We're going to be talking to one of your neighbors, Trevor Sheehy. So when we come back, we'll be talking to Trevor Sheehy, who is a retired attorney. And Trevor, I guess, bought into your association last year.
Yes.
And has found himself coming out of retirement again.
Yes, he's been doing all he could to try to help us.
Well, we'll be talking.
Which we really appreciate. And we appreciate you getting this on the air.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. I know that this is not something you do every day. And so I really appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk to us about it and get us a little more educated. And I wish you all the best.
I hope Trevor will do a better job than I did.
You did a beautiful job. You
but
did a wonderful job. And you gave us the basics. And I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Shirley.
Thank you, hon.
You take
Bye-bye.
Care. Bye. For the rest of you, please don't go away. We'll be right back. And when we come back, we will be talking to Trevor Sheehy. See you in a bit.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations
it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WEBR Fairfax Radio, I'm Sue Bartholomew. Welcome to On the Commons. During the first half of the program, we were joined by Shirley Clatham, who's a member of a mobile park association in California, in desert, hot desert, I think, California. And now we are joined by Trevor Sheehy. Trevor is a retired attorney who decided that he was going to take to the road and just take off RVing. And somehow he ended up in Desert Crest, which is the association we're talking about, and ended up staying there and coming, more or less coming out of retirement and getting involved with the absolute mess that's going on. Trevor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
I called, you know, one of your neighbors was, is a guy by the name of Charlie Honeycutt.
That's correct.
And he called me this morning, and I asked him, I said, Charlie, is there anything you want me to say on the air for you? And he said, yes, he's really perplexed that the appellate court accepted your brief, your amicus brief, but refused to hear your oral remarks, your oral arguments. And, you know, we'll get to that, but can you sort of give us a little background on how you got involved and what you've been doing with these folks?
Okay, how I got involved. Well, let me give you a background on the case.
All right.
This, I think to get an understanding of this case, we have to go back to a previous case that was decided in the Court of Appeals about a little over 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And that was Oscar B. Elkins. The issue there was whether or not Article 19 of the CC&Rs made payment of the dues mandatory to the club. The Superior Court interpreted the reading under the rules governing the interpretation of contracts or written instruments and found that it did not make payment of dues mandatory. This was appealed to the same appellate court, and the appellate court, applying the same rules to the interpretation of written instruments, found that dues were not mandatory. In the CC&Rs, there is a statement in, I believe it's Article 28, wherein it states that these CC&Rs may be amended, modified, or abrogated, maybe is the word, upon a majority vote of the association members. They had a vote, the legitimacy of which, in my mind, is questionable, but that's almost another program. And at that, as a result of that vote, they amended Article 19, which the courts had found to make dues optional, and they made it mandatory, or at least they attempted to. A strict reading of the amendment is makes that questionable, but the court has accepted it as making it mandatory. The people went to trial, and at the Superior Court level, Judge Stafford said, sorry, fellas, this is an amendment of contract, and you cannot amend contract by a simple majority vote. Everyone affected must vote for it. That was appealed, and we have a tentative opinion wherein they, in effect, say that a majority vote can amend the CC&Rs and add a new burden. Rather mind-boggling.
Let me ask you something. When you say a majority vote, you mean you have, what is it, 578 lots in
approximately, this? Approximately,
yes. Okay. Now, a majority would mean that 290 people can go ahead and vote?
Yes.
And 146, less than 150 of those can amend the governing documents?
No, I think what they came up with was it required a majority of all homeowners, not just the quorum. You were talking about, in this particular case, they claim to have had 300 votes, which is a majority of all lot owners.
Okay, so it's a simple majority.
Right.
And
now, what's intriguing about this, everybody looks at this and says, well, of course, you know, majority rules in this country. Sometimes think that the people really don't remember their basic American history. But in discussing with this classmate of mine who's an appellate specialist in Texas, we noted two interesting things, that really this is an ex post facto law, that after the fact they have come along and added a new burden. And that, intriguingly enough, since this is a private club, we wonder if this isn't taxation without representation, and that the owners don't set the tax themselves, and they don't vote on those who do set the tax.
You know, I wondered about that.
Those are interesting questions, but they're federal questions, I think, and they've never been brought up. Part of the problem has been that some of these issues regarding this whole organization have never been brought up. For example, I submitted a request that they take judicial notice of something, and it's for this basis, that for CC&Rs to be in effect, to lay on CC&Rs, to burden homeowners, you must own the land. Well, in checking out, when I came in, this case had already been decided at the Superior Court level. I was kind of intrigued by it, and remembering the admonishment of my real property professor in law school, I went back and started checking from the very beginning as to when these CC&Rs were founded. And what I found is that the legal title to this land was deeded over to a title company 2 days prior to when the CC&Rs were signed and recorded. Now, on the face of it, that means that the party signing those CC&Rs declared themselves to be owner, and only as owner could they impose these CC&Rs, but yet that person did not have legal title at the time those were signed. But that was never brought up at trial level. Whether or not the association is a legal association was not brought up at trial level. And the basis for that is that, or my contention that it is not a legal organization, is that this area was developed in three separate tracts. The first tract had a set of CC&Rs, the second tract had a set of CC&Rs, and the third tract had a set of CC&Rs.
Okay, were they the same?
Generally the same, and each one of them had a paragraph in there, not the same paragraph, but had a paragraph in which they noted that the rights of the developer could be passed over to a nonprofit organization to be formed under the laws of the state of California, and that those rights could be passed by the developer to that particular organization. Interestingly enough, there was never a nonprofit corporation formed. The rights for the first section were assigned in 1968, some 5 years later, to this for-profit corporation that had been formed. Well, let me finish the thought.
Okay.
But for sections 2 and 3, those rights were never assigned. And yet, the first for-profit corporation has been acting de facto representative of these other people. And the votes have been, on this issue, were taken, including their votes. Now, whether or not they had the right to vote on that is an issue that was never faced.
What comprises the first tract? Are there any private homes on there?
There are all private homes. The land is owned by each individual. There is no commonly owned property.
So why would you set up a for-profit corporation?
The for-profit corporation, I'm assuming now, I'm...
See, that doesn't make any sense.
If I were the developer, I would have set it up for the following reasons. As a nonprofit corporation, if you are a landowner, no matter how much land you own, it is my understanding you only have one vote.
Okay.
But with a for-profit corporation, where there are shares, and they actually got permission to sell shares, that if I owned say the first developer, the first section was 280 lots, and I own 280 lots. As I sold those lots, I would still be able to outvote and, in effect, have control of the property until I had sold out more than half. So it gave the developer more control over this. In effect, the developer in the early stages had total control. Primarily, one of the reasons was being that land was not being sold directly. It was being sold, in large part, it was being sold by contract of sale. Now, legally, that means that if I own property and you want to buy it, and I say, well, I'm not going to give you the deed for this, but you and I will enter into a contract in which, under which you will pay me X amount of money each month for so many years, and at the completion of that period of time and completion of all those payments, then I will give you the deed. So, in effect, he retained, in his mind, or on the surface, legal title. So, does that...
That's
complicated,
sort of,
but...
Okay, that kind of makes sense. Because most associations are not-for-profit, and when you don't have any common areas, and the first tract comprises nothing but individual lots, I don't see how anybody's going to make a profit on that. But now you've explained it.
Right.
So, okay.
So, in effect, when the developer, it's interesting in that it looked like, very possibly, under the statutes then effect in the county, that the developer should have been required to sign over these recreational facilities to the homeowners.
Okay, and then...
But that didn't occur. And the reason I say that is that at that time in the county of Riverside, the minimum lot size, as I understand it, was 7,200 square feet. These lots are 3,600 square feet. And the idea being that that could be done because there would be recreational facilities which would be presented to the homeowners. That was never occurred. These facilities were retained by the developer, and dues were paid to the private club.
What about tracks 2 and tracks 3?
Tracks 2 and tracks 3 adjoin track 1. Track 2 adjoins it on one side, and track 3 joins it on the other side.
So track 1's in the middle.
And the little, and I say little accurately, it's about 8 acres of a pitch and putt 9-hole course adjoin or in the middle of the first section. And the clubhouse swimming pool is at the end of the first section.
Oh, wait a minute. So it was designed so that it's smack bang in the middle of the development.
That's correct.
And yet it was privately owned.
Yes.
And it's open to everyone.
Yes. This is not an exclusive club. In that there's a sign out on the main road adjoining the property, on property still owned by the developer, that says the golf court is open to the public.
Okay.
So it's not a private club. It's not exclusive. They could have memberships to anybody. In fact, the club does rent out its meeting rooms to whoever wants to pay the tab. So it's not private. But yet, in this decision, the intriguing thing about this decision is that it really doesn't address the issue of whether or not you have the right to add a new burden. It discusses other clubs, other states, in which courts have said that if that were included in the original CC&R, it could be upheld. But it wasn't included in this original CC&R. So the court's reasoning, amazingly enough, seems to be that G, and I'm putting that in italics, the original intention of the developer was to make this a mandatory payment. And it was just a terrible oversight.
Well, you shoot someone and you say, gee whiz, it was my intention for the bullet to go 3 inches to one side of his head and miss him completely, what are the courts going to say then?
Well, of course they're going to say, oh, really?
So what's the difference?
It eludes me. I don't see it either. I think that's an interesting analogy.
I mean, we're trying to decide what the developer's intent was 40 years ago.
Yes. And isn't that intriguing?
And so then we're going to rule based on what the court thinks that the intent of the thing was, the developer was?
Well, the words seem to infer, in my mind, that I infer from it that that's what they're saying. That it's, it was all a big mistake, and they really meant to do that.
Well, what happened to, that's nice, if that's what you intended to do, then you should have done it. I mean, isn't that the way the courts generally operate, Trevor?
You would think so. What's intriguing is that a few years back in the preceding case, the court very assiduously referred to all the rules set out and actually encoded in California Civil Code, rules for the interpretation of written instruments. This time, they seem to have eluded all of it, one which might be, I think, in my mind, distorted to justify their conclusion. In my amicus brief, I think I made the point that the true issue here was whether or not you can add by majority vote a new burden. And quoted, there were no cases in California that ever said you could, and gave a couple of out-of-state cases by Supreme Courts of two different states wherein it was stated, these words cannot be interpreted to give the authority to add new burdens. This court never quite addressed that point. It kept alluding as if it was all a mistake. This was really they took the position that this was actually a covenant that could run with the land if it had been included.
But it wasn't included.
But it wasn't included. Absolutely right. But the cases they cite are ones in which it had been included originally and which were upheld. But we didn't have that. So their cases are really not germane to this case.
And there's an article that was written by one of your local papers ruling homeowners must pay fees. In it, it sort of said that this was a tentative decision. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the court sent out a tentative. It does. It will issue a tentative position, and then it will. It says you can have oral arguments. I am thumbing through a document here, which I think is extremely interesting.
Okay.
In that it comes down to accompanying the tentative decision is the following statement. Enclosed is the tentative opinion of a majority of the three-judge panel hearing the appeal. Note this. The court has determined that, one, the record and briefs adequately present the facts and legal arguments. Two, oral argument will not aid the decision-making process. Isn't that interesting?
So, you know,
isn't that saying this is tentative, but our mind's made up?
That sounds like it.
But if you, it goes on to say that, and this will just delay things and you're wasting time, but it does say that, well, if you ask, we'll give you 15 minutes of oral argument. I filed a petition to be included in the oral argument. Stating that my position and the points I had brought up were so different from those brought up by the party's attorney that I would need 15 minutes. They turned me down. They said if the other party wanted to give me some of their time, when I say the other party.
The association.
The
country club.
The attorney representing Shirley, with whom you spoke earlier.
Oh, okay.
See, I'm an amicus curiae. They have their own attorney.
Okay, so you're not part of...
As an amicus curiae, I took an entirely different approach.
Okay.
Now, he has informed me that he can give me 5 of his 15 minutes. So, in effect, I have 5 minutes to attempt to get through the court. But I'm leery because I read their notices, in effect, telling me that I'm not going to get through.
So
intriguing point. But again.
So they're going to turn their minds off when you talk. They're not.
Yeah. I don't know. I certainly am not going to accuse anybody of that, but I think they might understand why I'm apprehensive.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's a done deal. They've already made up their minds.
Everyone that has read this has said the same thing. Every one of my friends who have read this say, whoa.
How much publicity has this got? I know it got, it was in a local paper. Was it in any of the bigger California publications?
Not that I know of.
TV, right?
Those people who are interested, they can go to website, the American Home...
AHRC.com, American Homeowners Resource Center.
Right.
And there's a lot of information there.
And by tomorrow, on that, they will be able to see the tentative opinion.
Okay.
And they will be able to see the briefs of the parties. So any attorneys who are listening and are intrigued by this, they can go on to that site and read the briefs and the tentative opinion. If they have points...
You'd love to hear them.
I am desperate to get insight. I have called around, and as I say, I have a friend who's an appellate specialist in Texas that I've sent all the information to, not realizing it was on the website, or would be. And I need whatever help input I can get for ways, creative ways of getting to the court in those 5 minutes. My real concern is that this, and people ought to consider this, that this sets a precedent that could have far-reaching effects. At the risk of being pedantic, I'm going to read the definition of a precedent.
Okay.
It says, in law, a judicial decision, interlocutory or final, which serves as a rule for future determination in similar or analogous cases. Any proceeding or course of proceedings which may serve for a rule in subsequent cases of like nature. So, in effect, if another association takes a vote and gets the majority of vote or whatever the vote required under their governing documents, this could, they can, in effect, impose new burdens.
So you don't even... Okay, so they can...
And cite this case if it's ever challenged.
They can use deceit, fraud... They can use fraud, they can manipulate the system, they can rig an election, and they can force anybody who's in an association, whether or not it's a common interest association or not, to go ahead and be forced to pay dues or belong to Gold's Gym or, you know, Disney World.
Well, it leaves it open, Sue. It, in effect, says the conclusion one must draw from this is if the CC&Rs, or the governing documents of the association, say that amendments can be made by this percentage of the homeowners, then they can impose a new burden, something that no one had anticipated. For example, in my brief, I noted that if you look at the CC&Rs, which allegedly govern this association, these things deal with very simple matters. They say you can't, the type of building you can put on, and this is a mobile home park, a place where the majority of people winter. That's why I bought it. I'm here now in the summer only because I'm involved in this case. But it sets up property lines. You can't build any closer to this. You can't have a huge TV antenna, which apparently was coming in at the time. You can't build closer than this. Very simple.
Basically, mirroring what a zoning ordinance would be.
Yes, similar. Right. If you went to the county, you'd probably find similar deals.
Yes.
And so when people sign this thing, and back on, this is a four-page instrument they get,
uh-huh.
and they don't sign it, but this is a four-page instrument they would have to read and would get when they were buying their house.
Right.
Or buying the land. Back in paragraph 28 of this, I believe it's 28, there is this little statement mixed down in like an 8 or 9 line paragraph, which says this can be amended, modified, or abrogated. I think it's abrogated, by a majority vote. Now, you would look at that, and you would think, well, these CC&Rs are only dealing with these particular things. And historically, what has occurred is that these CC&Rs over a period of time turn out to be no longer necessary, and this gives them the authority to just take a vote and get rid of the CC&R. But the words used have now been interpreted to say that you can add anything. What's intriguing to me is that no one has, and this thought has just been developing in my mind, is that suppose three of us owned a piece of property. Your best friend, you, and me owned a piece of property.
Okay.
I could not go down and lay a burden on that property just by myself. You and I, if we were in agreement, could not go down and lay a burden on that property just by our, quote, majority vote. It would require unanimous consent of all three parties, stating that we as owners lay these burdens on. Yet we have a situation where the developer has given the authority, which he would not have.
That's an interesting point, Trevor.
To say to a majority of homeowners, you can modify and add a new burden. And yet, if the 580 of you own this together, you could not have done this originally.
That's a very interesting point.
It boggles the mind how the court is overlooking these issues. Now, I realize I did not bring this to their attention because I was extremely concerned that I would even get them to accept an amicus curiae brief.
They did.
And I realized if I got into things that sounded extremely complex, they would just, quote, shine me on, unquote. So I kept it what I thought was very direct. In fact, I found one case which I thought was the great white elephant, in which the court had noted that you could not add, in fact, originally, no burdensome covenant could have been added because this association was formed prior to an amendment to the civil code, which allowed that. They noted that, and yet they turned around and applied that civil code section, which the case said couldn't be applied.
That's unbelievable. Trevor, we're out of time.
I understand.
I really, this is an absolutely fascinating, fascinating issue, and, please keep in touch. I really want to follow this.
Well, let me add something. Hopefully on that website will be a fund. If people realize that this is going to have far-reaching effect, they might want to contribute to a fund. These people are retired, fixed income. We're talking about they've already spent $30,000 in attorney's fees. It could take that amount to appeal this case.
Okay. All right. That's at AHRC.com.
Right. And next week I'll have set up a fund with a bank account, and we'll have the name so that people, and hopefully we'll have it set up so that they can use their charge cards and send money to this fund.
Okay, well, we'll keep you guys posted, but I want to thank you for joining us, Trevor, and I'm going to have to get out of here because I've got my friend Curtis is here and is ready to take over the hot seat. Thanks.
Well, look, if you want to go further on this or any details or people listed points, we might have an interesting discussion among attorneys.
I will definitely be in touch with you, Trevor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the forum.
And thanks for hanging out with me on the Commons today. Please stay tuned. Thank you, Trevor.
Bye.
Please stay tuned because on the Commons...